I just want to briefly introduce you to the verse we've chosen as our text for the year, for 2008. It's great when God really speaks to you through a sermon. And that's what sermons are actually for. They're meant to be occasions for God to speak to us through His Word. And God spoke to me through a sermon recently. In fact, it was only a couple of weeks ago, actually. And it was a sermon I preached myself. It's great when God speaks to you through one of your own sermons. And I actually preached this sermon, and I found God speaking to me through the sermon more after I'd preached it than He did even when I was preparing it and preaching it. I don't know whether you remember the sermon. It was about two Sunday nights ago. And it was a sermon I preached on prayer. And it was based on two of the parables of Jesus. We've been doing a little mini-series on some of the parables of Jesus. And we looked at two of His parables in Luke on prayer. It was the parable of the persistent widow and the parable of the friend at midnight. I just want to remind you of those two parables and the points I made from them, which have been speaking to me powerfully ever since. As I say, more so than they did even when I was preparing them. I don't know whether any other preachers here have had that experience of preaching a sermon and finding that God actually speaks to you through the sermon that you've preached. It's a tremendous experience. Well, the two parables were the parable of the persistent widow and the parable of the friend at midnight. And both of these are examples of people in impossible situations at the end of their own resources. And both of them, out of a sense of real urgency and desperation and need, ask boldly and persistently and determinedly and seriously. Let's look at the widow first. I think we'll actually read the parable through. You'll find it in Luke chapter 18. Luke's Gospel chapter 18. Verse 1. Then Jesus told His disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up. He said, "In a certain town there was a judge who neither feared God nor cared about men. And there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him with the plea, 'Grant me justice against my adversary.' For some time he refused. But finally he said to himself, 'Even though I don't fear God or care about men, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she won't eventually wear me out with her coming.' And the Lord said, 'Listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God bring about justice for His chosen ones who cry out to Him day and night? Will He keep putting them off? I tell you, He will see that they get justice and quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will He find faith on the earth?'" Now, the widow is a proverbial example in the Bible of someone in need, someone who is powerless, somebody who is helpless. Women generally had no power in New Testament times. They had no influence. They had no clout in society at all. And in a law court, they had absolutely no say, no influence at all. A court was an exclusively male preserve. If you were a woman, you had to have a husband to represent you in a court of law. Well, this woman was a widow. She had no husband to represent her, no husband to speak up for her. Being a widow, she was poor. There was no welfare state. There were no benefits in those days. She would have been poor. She had been wronged. And she couldn't afford to be wronged and to be cheated. She had no bribe. She was poor. She was a widow. She had no bribe. She couldn't bribe the judge. And when you're thinking of a court in New Testament times, you mustn't think of a British court, a place of silence and dignity and decorum, the sort of court we know. You must think of a crowd of noisy men, all yelling, all pushing, And the judge is corrupt. He doesn't fear God or man. All he wants is the biggest bribe. That's all he's interested in, just the biggest bribe. And the person with the biggest bribe will be at the front of the queue. And the person with the biggest bribe will win the case. It's as simple as that. So this widow just didn't stand a chance. She didn't stand a chance. And she could well have said, well, why bother? She could have very easily just given up and not even tried. But she couldn't afford not to bother. She had no money. She was a widow and she had been cheated. She had a case and she couldn't afford to lose that case. She couldn't afford for that case not to be heard. If she didn't get justice, then she faced ruin. So, says Jesus, she kept coming. She kept bothering this corrupt judge. That's the word the judge uses in the NIV. She keeps bothering me. She kept coming, she kept bothering him. She made a nuisance of herself. And eventually, she wore him down. And he dealt with her case, not because he cared for her, but just to get some peace and quiet, just to get her off his back. And then there was the man, and we'll read this parable as well, Luke chapter 11, Luke's Gospel chapter 11, the friend at midnight. Luke chapter 11, verse 5. Then he said to them, suppose one of you has a friend, and he goes to him at midnight and says, friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread, because a friend of mine on a journey has come to me, and I have nothing to set before him. Then the one inside answers, don't bother me, the door is already locked, and my children are with me in bed. I can't get up and give you anything. I tell you, though he will not get up and give him the bread because he is his friend, yet because of the man's boldness, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. So here's a man, and visitors turn up. It's always embarrassing when visitors turn up, isn't it? But visitors turn up at midnight. Totally unexpected. And he has no bread. Bread was the staple diet in New Testament time. No bread meant no food. So visitors turn up, no food. A comparatively minor domestic crisis, you might think, compared to the widow that we've just been reading about. Yes, but not quite so minor as it would be for us, because expectations in that culture were very high with regard to hospitality. People expected hospitality. And this chap, whoever it was who turned up at midnight, would have expected hospitality, and the village would have expected this visitor to their village to have been given hospitality as well. It was part of the culture. It was a culture of hospitality in that society in those days. So what do? Friend turns up at midnight. You've got no bread. What do? Well, says Jesus, you swallow your pride and you go and knock on the next door. At midnight. You go and knock the next door neighbour up at midnight. And waking him up, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, in that society meant waking up the rest of the house as well. They were all in the same bed. Not just in the same bedroom, they were all in the same bed. So if one of them got up, they all woke up. That's made clear in the story. And there was a big lock to manipulate, and you mustn't think of a nice little lock that we're used to. You must think of some great big wooden contraption which you had to manipulate at midnight just to give this next door neighbour 3 loaves of bread. Jesus says, well, you've got to swallow your pride and you've got to do that. You've got to knock on your neighbour's door, you've got to wake him up, wake up the rest of the house as well. And the likelihood is, if you have the cheek to do that, if you are impudent enough to do that, you will probably get your bread. You'll probably try to avoid your neighbour next morning, but you'll probably get your bread. He won't get up and unlock the door because he's pleased to see you, but just to get you off his door and to get back into bed again. And again, here's a man who is at the end of his own resources. He's got no bread. And he needs some. And the point of the parable is, if you don't ask, you go without. So I say to you, says Jesus, ask, and it will be given you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. Now, both these parables are parables of contrast rather than parables of comparison. Most parables are parables of comparison. These two parables are parables of contrast. By that I mean that God is not a corrupt judge. He is, says Jesus, committed to bringing about justice for his chosen ones. Absolutely committed to bringing about justice for his chosen ones. And the point of the parable is, if serious, desperate, determined, urgent asking can move even a self-centered villain of a corrupt judge, how much more will it move the God who cares for us and who is committed to justice for his chosen one? And with regard to the second parable, if bold, persistent, shameless asking can get a sleepy neighbour out of bed at midnight, how much more will bold, shameless asking cause our Father, who delights to give the Holy Spirit to his children, to hear our prayers? That's the point of both the parables. In other words, we pray with far more faith and far more expectation than either this widow or this embarrassed host at midnight. Now, what particularly spoke to me as I preached the sermon 2 weeks ago, and you might think, well, it's funny him preaching the same sermon again as he preached 2 weeks ago. Well, it is, I suppose, but why not? I mean, if God has spoken, why not? He's spoken to me, and I assume that means that he might want to speak to you as well. And the point that got to me was that this widow is us. This widow is the church. And this embarrassed host with no bread is us. He is the church. And it's when we see how utterly powerless we are and utterly needy and utterly weak that we will really seriously pray. And the point of the parables is that when we seriously pray out of a sense of desperate need, really desperate need, we can expect God to hear us. The context of the persistent widow parable, is the tribulation that the church will experience before the return of the Son of Man. The whole of the church age will be an age of tribulation, the New Testament says. It may well get worse as time goes on, but it will be an age of tribulation. And Jesus, at the end of the parable, says, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? That word faith can be translated faithfulness. And he probably means, will he find this kind of determined, helpless, believing prayer on the earth when he returns? It is only that kind of prayer, this kind of prayer, that will get the church through this tribulation that the church can expect at all times. Okay. Now, it was because God had spoken to me clearly through these two parables that I suggested, and it's my suggestion, so blame me, I suggested our aim for the year, our motto for the year. And our motto for the year, and it can go up on the screen now, if you like, Hannah, our motto for the year is taken from 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 11. We read it in our Bible reading. You're all going to get a nice picture of whatever lake that is. I'm not quite sure what it is. It looks as if it's the Lake District, but it might not be. You're going to get a nice picture of that lake with those words on it, taken from 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 11. The words of King Asa, "Lord, there is none like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, O Lord, for we rely on you." King Asa, king of Judah, had been attacked or was about to be attacked by the Cushites, a much larger army. A vast army, it says in the NIV. And the NIV footnote, it says that the Hebrew means an army of 1,000 thousands. Or thousands upon thousands. A vast army. And his response is to call upon the Lord his God. And again, he describes himself and Judah as powerless. There is none like you to help the powerless. And he describes the enemy as mighty. Remember the widow? Remember the friend at midnight? At the end of their own resources, powerless. Lord, there is none like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, O Lord, for we rely on you. We must really and truly see ourselves as powerless. This is the particular thing that God has been reminding me about. Utter powerlessness and the might of the enemy. The enemy is far mightier than we are. We really are in great and desperate need. Traditionally, the enemies of the church are described as the world, the flesh, and the devil. I mean, one of them, one enemy would be bad enough, but this is gang warfare. Three of them, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And they're all mightier than we are. The world is mightier than we are. The flesh within us, the old sinful nature, the remnants of that old sinful nature within us is mightier than we are. And the devil is mightier than we are. And unless the Lord helps us, then we will be defeated. Look at the world. If you look at the church in the world today, you'll find that in place after place, persecution is growing. Sometimes obvious, blatant persecution in more and more countries. And even in our own country, you can see developments taking place, which is going to make it more and more difficult for us to stand firm as biblical Christians in the future. It's going to get tougher and tougher. It's going to get harder and harder unless God seriously intervenes. There's a threat of persecution from the world. There's intellectual opposition. 2007 has been the year when the atheists have been constantly in the best-selling lists. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. Constantly, first of all the hardback, and then the paperback. I think the paperback was the third best-selling book in Britain in 2007. And that was followed up by Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great, and two or three other militantly atheistic books as well. And increasingly, when you read the newspapers, when you read people like Matthew Parrish in the Times and so on, taking a much more militantly atheistic stance, a much more obviously anti-Christian stance. Matthew Parrish, a couple of weeks ago in the Times, had an article saying that we ought to know every MP's religious view. We ought to know whether he is a Christian or not. And that should influence whether or not we vote for him. And his point was that if you know a person because of his religious views, has strong views about abortion or strong views about homosexuality. We ought to know that so that we can vote against them. So there's the growing power of the world against the church. There's the power of the flesh, what the Bible calls the flesh, the sinful nature. It really is powerful, you know. Unless we pray, we're going to backslide. The flesh is powerful. The devil is powerful. Unless God helps us, we will backslide. It's as simple as that. We will not persevere. We will not continue in the Christian faith unless God helps us. So we really must see how powerless we are and how mighty the world is. The situation is desperate. We will backslide if we don't pray. Even if we keep up appearances and keep up turning regularly at church, even if we're active in church life outwardly, we will backslide if we do not pray. So as individuals, we're powerless, and as a church, we're powerless. The odds are stacked against us, just as they were here in 2 Chronicles chapter 14. And therefore, out of a sense of real helplessness, with Asa, we must turn to God and say, Lord, there is none like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, O Lord, for we rely on you. If we don't pray, we really will be in big trouble. Bible reading and Bible teaching, sound expository preaching, without prayer will just make us big-headed, arrogant, and people who feel superior to other folk who don't know the Bible as well as we do. We must pray. And therefore, the reason why I've chosen this motto for 2008 is not just for it to be a nice picture and a nice verse to put on our mantelpieces. It really must be our motto for 2008. We really must see our desperate need, the might of the enemy, but we must also see the power of God. And we must turn to him like this widow turned to the unjust judge. And we must go to God like this man at midnight went to his sleepy friend. And we must call upon God out of a sense of real helplessness. And if we do, we can expect to be heard.